evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Mara Alper. Alper is an associate professor in the television radio department at Ithaca College. She's an award-winning media artist and documentary filmmaker. Her most recent work is the groundbreaking documentary Forgiveness, which features world-renowned leader Desmond Tutu. Welcome to the show, Mara.
Hi.
Now, I want to ask you, what was it that attracted you to the medium of documentary filmmaking?
Well, I started out studying theater and English when I was in college, and I learned film editing. That was my first entree into it. But I always say that I have a devotion to motion because I love dancing, I love moving images, I love storytelling. And I think for me, the fact that I could pull together all of the elements of theater plus the moving image really is what drew me into that area.
And were you a child that was wandering around with a video camera like so many filmmakers I've met started out?
There were no video cameras when I was a child, so I was a young adult wandering around with a video camera, but no, I didn't have a film camera then either. My grandfather had a film camera, but I didn't actually use it very much. No, I was running around playing.
Huh. Now, you've also mentioned, also in your biography, and you just mentioned it now, what is this affinity with dance that you're so attracted to?
I consider it my strongest source of energy in some ways. Like other people get tired from dancing, I get energy from dancing. And the dance I've done I've done all different kinds of dance, but mainly it's dance that's done barefoot into drums, but then also flamenco and tango and social dancing too. But there's something just very powerful about the life force that comes through one when one dances if you yield to it.
Uh-huh. And why did you not choose dance as your career?
My body's not that flexible. I work around at stiff places. I move to the maximum that I'm able to.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I noticed that there are a lot of images of dance in your films.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a little, I don't know, a logo for your stuff. Now, one of your earliest films is called Silent Echoes, an experimental dance film. Well, what were you trying to say in that? It's mysterious, that film.
Well, I worked in the corporate world for many years as a writer, producer, director. And I was struck by the invisibility that women often have in that environment, even though you had essential roles, but there's still this way of being invisible at times. And I began thinking about your life outside of your work life and your inner life versus your outer life. And that's what that film is mainly about, the contrast between the very spirited inner life of a very powerful Haitian American dancer compared with her life in the workplace, mm-hmm. and people's reaction to it. And then the effect that people opening to seeing people's true natures can have, the positive effect that can have.
Mm-hmm. And that was very noticeable in that film. She did seem powerful while she was dancing, and then when you had the office scenes, and it was almost like people dismissed her,
mm-hmm.
or she was invisible. Mm-hmm. They're very interesting. Now you tackled a very delicate subject with another early film called Stories No One Wants to Hear. Now, it's about incest and victims of that kind of abuse. How did you get people to publicly be involved in that film? It's a hard one to talk about.
Yeah, it was not easy. Whenever I do pieces, I just start asking around. I just start telling people what it is I have in mind, and then people recommend people to me. It ended up being women in the film talking about being abused by their mothers and one brother, so it was a little different than people's usual expectation of the father or daughter. And I did try to get men to be in it, because there are many men who have been abused by their mothers,
mm-hmm.
but they were not willing to be on camera. The only ones who were the women. And it took a lot of finessing, but mainly people realized that one, telling their stories was healing for them, and two, that by telling their stories, they could help other people heal.
Mm-hmm. And that was the point of the film, is to open up a dialogue. And have you taken this around, and has it worked well as a tool?
Yeah, I made that film in 1993, and it's been in continuous distribution for 15 years. And the use of it that I did not anticipate is it's been used widely for empathy training for perpetrators.
Mm-hmm.
So people who have, you know, gone into the legal system with issues of abuse and incest watch this, and then there's discussions for them to understand what the child has felt like, because people think that children don't remember. People think that, you know, if the kid is young, they won't have any recollection. People think children don't take these things in, but it's imprinted on your body and your spirit.
Now, did some of the people who appeared in this film, did they also come to some of these workshops and stuff and talk openly about their lives?
It depended on the location.
I see.
But mainly I was the one who was speaking and presenting the films. And it's gotten presented, its biggest presentation was the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Dallas Museum of Art, Boston Museum of Fine Arts. And this past year, the U.S. Department of Defense actually bought copies of it, and Langley Air Force Base, they bought multiple copies through one of the distributors of it, which was very interesting to me. And you know, it's always a little discouraging that it's still prevalent, but it's also heartening that the people are talking about it more and working on it more. Mm-hmm. And the piece, even though it's a heavy subject, the idea is that it is optimistic, that when you enter these very dark realms, it's very painful, it's very hard, mm-hmm. but the promise is that at the end of it, you not only see the light, but you have this burden lifted off of you, and your life opens up in ways that it hadn't before.
Mm-hmm. And one of the women in the film does say that it had been therapeutic for her, indeed. Now, you've studied world mythologies and religions, and tell us how you got interested in these subjects. So you focused on Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell as well. Tell us about that.
In college, I took a course in philosophy of religion, and I don't know that we were assigned. We did talk about Jung, and probably Campbell was in there too, but my recollection is wandering through the college library in that section and pulling books off the shelf and randomly reading them, which I still like to do. Now I do it online also. But finding a book by Carl Jung, reading it, and in only the way a 20-year-old can say, feeling that I had finally found somebody else that saw the world the way I did. Uh-huh. Because I feel that I've always been conscious of the things people have in common globally and between religions, and that those are the things that we need to emphasize more and be more conscious of. We're very conscious of the differences, and they're always played up. But when you start looking at the stories human beings tell each other and about their lives, there's much more in common than different.
Mm-hmm. I remember being enthralled by Carl Jung's, especially his autobiography when I was young. Yeah. Now, when you come up with an idea for a film, how does that develop? Is it an image, a visual image you see, or do you decide on a subject and go from there? To tell us how the process works.
Well, it varies for each piece. Sometimes some of them have begun as dreams. Silent Echoes began as a dream. Some of the imagery and stories no one wants to hear came out of a dream. I was working on this piece. I had an artist residency at McDowell Colony, and I had a dream while I was editing the piece of digging in the sand for a lost key. Mm. And so I woke up the next day, and I got one of the other artists to help me and just filmed that as a visual metaphor for, you know, this digging to find the lost self. So it can come either way, but it's always a very gradual process, an unfolding. And I gather a lot of material, like for the forgiveness one, I did 25 hour-and-a-half to two-hour interviews and narrowed it down to four that I chose to tell in the end. I did around 75 different interviews on the street with people, just walking up to people and saying, what do you think about forgiveness? And in the end, that didn't even make it into the final piece. That could be a separate piece on its own. Mm-hmm. So it varies a lot. But what I find is consistent is that I view these things, I look for the hot spots, like the either the hardest stories or the most intense part of the story. And then when I go to edit, I work out from there. So it may not be the beginning of the story, or I don't know where it's going to be in the story, but it's the part that I feel just the strongest, most passionate part of the storytelling is happening, and then work from there.
Mm-hmm. And do you usually collaborate with people, or do you try to do all this by yourself?
Well, I'm always collaborating with people in terms of there are people in it, you know, the people that are the subjects of it. As the media has gotten more and more digital and compact, I can carry a whole video studio with me in a small day pack, my computer, camera, microphone, hard drive, and just be completely portable, which is part of what I've been doing in Mexico when I go down there working on the Huichol tribe. Mm-hmm. But I like collaborating. But, you know, you're the only one that's always free the same time as you are, so.
Let's talk a little bit about your film Forgiveness, which you just mentioned. Very powerful film. What made you decide to tackle that subject?
Well, through life experiences that I had where I came to my own place of forgiveness about things, and it wasn't through anything I'd read or anything anybody told me or encouraged me to do. It was, I just felt that it was the only way I was going to be able to move on from the difficulties I was having. And I found Robert Enright, who is at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and he has a model, five-step model for forgiveness. And there are several models, but his I could relate to most closely.
Can you tell us what some of the levels are?
One is that you recognize that you've been hurt and that there is wrongdoing that's been done. And that by recognizing it, you're not condoning the person's behavior, but you're just saying, yes, this has happened. And then you need to confront that anger and really know, admit it, own it, not try to bury it, not try to, you know, suppress it or whitewash it or say, oh, well, you know, those kinds of things. And then there's the decision point where you decide whether or not to forgive, understanding what forgiveness is and is not, and that it is not condoning it. It's not saying what they did is okay. It's not okay. But it is a way for you to release from the other person, to release from the anger you're feeling towards them, release from the hatred you're feeling towards them, release from all of those dark feelings that really have much more effect on you than it has on the other person. And it has great physical effects also by, you know, being able to do that. And what that requires is actually empathy and compassion. And that's very hard to do. It's not an easy thing, and it's especially hard, I think, in our culture. It's not generally encouraged. We're very into vengeance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So to be able to really see where that person was coming from when they did this incredibly hurtful thing towards you takes a great deal of effort, actually.
Mm-hmm. And do you think one can do it on their own? Did you find any surprises in this forgiveness film? Or does someone have to be taken through it with a professional, usually?
I think you can do it on your own if you've already are somebody who understands empathy and compassion. I think then it's possible that that will come to you as a way of solving it. But I think if you're not oriented towards that, you're probably not going to find it on your own. When I did all those interviews with people on the street, there was no gray area. I asked them what they thought about forgiveness, and there wasn't gray area. Either they believed in it or they didn't believe in it. And I think the ones who don't believe in it could be encouraged to see its benefits, because this model, the Enright model and several others, is that when you forgive somebody, it's to benefit yourself, that you're not doing it for them. You're doing it for you, mm-hmm. so that you can move on from these hard feelings, you know, so you can get on with your life, so you can open up your heart and not have it closed down.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great story, a man in Ithaca, I won't use his name because I didn't check with him before, but his daughter, when I was making this, said, oh, you have to talk to my father. And actually, it had been made already. Otherwise, I would have loved to have had him in it. She said, you have to talk to my father. He said that he used up his first heart by not forgiving.
Oh, what an
interesting. He had major heart problems. He had a heart transplant. And he felt that by not forgiving, he had caused all this physical problems with his heart. And there are studies now showing that the effect of stress and of holding these the negative feelings mm-hmm. has this very powerful physiological effect. So that's a huge way that it benefits somebody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, people often talk about how hate can eat you alive and eat you from the inside, but people don't say that much about forgiveness. You don't hear that often. There was an interesting statement by one of the people in the film that the church tells you to forgive, but it does not tell you how to do so. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, and that was a minister saying that.
Uh-huh.
So all of our, you know, Judeo-Christian texts talk about forgiveness. A lot of it is about God being forgiven, but, you know, sometimes it's for us to be forgiven. But it just says, do it. And it's not an instant process. It's a really slow, deep process.
Oh,
and it
I'm
takes
sure.
time, and you go through layers of it, and you think you've forgiven the person, and then you see them, and you want to strangle them, so you realize, okay, you've still got more work to do, or, you know, you need guidelines for it and encouragement and other people probably who are going through the process or have gone through to say, yeah, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. It will be better, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever find any follow-up or find any instances where people who have forgiven, how has it affected the one who did the bad deed? Did you ever find out?
Oh, well, you know, that may never affect them at all. And the odds are that they're not going to really say they're sorry. They may, but that would not be the main expectation.
Yeah.
You can't hope for that.
So, but I was just wondering if you'd ever found it during this.
There are some. Mm-hmm. There are some, but it's the exception. I would say most people are pretty locked into themselves being right.
Yeah, or else in denial, I would assume. Now you got to an opportunity to interview Desmond Tutu. What was that like?
Well, I was fortunate because he came to Ithaca right when I was working on this piece. So I went to the huge group lecture, and then I made myself part of the press corps the next day at Cornell. I found out from other videographers that was happening. And the other people in the press corps were asking questions about some current event that didn't have that, much to do with things he was interested in. He spoke about it, but I kept asking about forgiveness, and his answers were amazing. I mean, he's a remarkable human being, and I feel very grateful to have been able to meet with him one-to-one, because his level of compassion, his level of empathy, his level of commitment to people telling their stories, his level of commitment to the need for forgiveness and reconciliation, for people to heal, and for, in his case, nations to heal and move on. It's a huge commitment.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mara Alper. She's a documentary filmmaker and a professor in the television and radio department at Ithaca College. Were you already planning to make this film about forgiveness when you met Bishop Tutu? Is that how you decided to put him in the film, or was he already on your list?
No, I was already making it. In fact, Jimmy Carter was on my list because I have a friend who is personal friends with him. And so he was the one who I was trying to, make contact with. And then Desmond Tutu was announced that he was coming to town, and I just felt incredibly fortunate. And before I had interviewed him, I had been out at a conference in Salt Lake City on forgiveness, and it was social scientists and philosophers and political scientists and me. And I interviewed a number of them, and one woman was a lawyer advocate at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And so my interview with her was about her work directly with Desmond Tutu. And a few years after that interview, he came to Ithaca, so I was very fortunate in being able to put those interviews together. And that's part of why it's a long process, because you're open and receptive to these things. And
And have you found this film to make a difference for people? It's been showing up in many places.
It has. It's mostly been used. It's been used in colleges, at universities. The main audience for it so far has been through religious organizations and prison programs.
Really?
Because they do a lot of work with forgiveness. One whole segment of forgiveness is forgiving yourself. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, that's the hardest thing to do. So I think I feel, I'd say, disappointed, but that's not the right word. But I'm hoping that this topic can be used in a broader community. We put it in a religious category. We put it in a religious spiritual category. We put it somewhat into psychological, but we don't put it into a mainstream category.
Like philosophy.
Yeah, I know it's not like love, but it could be discussed as much as love or any interpersonal relationships. So it's pigeonholed into the religions at this point. But the ministries have been using it. It's been used quite a bit in England and Canada, which
really
indicates something to me about the openness to that idea. We have a number of, we have a Forgiveness Institute, an international forgiveness organizations here, and they've been using it too.
Now you teach in the television and radio department at Ithaca College, and one of your specialties is motion graphics as well as animation. Mm-hmm. Tell us what that means.
Oh, that's more devotion to motion for me. But you use complex software in order to move around either text or objects or moving images in a way that creates the illusion of a 3D space on the flat screen. So it's a lot of fun. It's hard to do. It's got a lot of visual design involved with it, conceptualization, having a vision of what you want, and then working the tool to make it take form.
Mm-hmm.
The students like it a lot.
Are you somebody who lived in the era when we didn't have computers to help us with all this stuff, and you actually had to hand make animation and so on?
Yeah, I was actually a puppeteer for 15 years. While I was a freelance writer and producer in New York City, I was also a puppeteer. And so my animation was puppets, with a puppet film. They're flat silhouette puppets. And so that's how I started with animation and using these three-dimensional. I'm definitely not a digital native. I'm way too old for that. But I do like digital technology, and I started using it in the 80s. I was paid to learn to do video editing on a computer because I'd been a film editor. So I was very glad that I could get paid for learning it and then, you know, continued with it afterwards.
Well, do you think some of the creative process is missing from the early days when one actually had to use their imagination and not go, oh, I'll find that on Photoshop? Or is it the same kind of creative process?
Yeah, I think it's the same creative process. I get concerned about the physiology of it, that your eyes get very overstrained from the screen. Mm. Your hands are doing a very limited range of, you know, motion and the dexterity, as opposed to, you know, making things three-dimensionally and moving them. And we are doing one stop-motion animation, which is we'll use objects, but... Mm. I'm concerned about what the outcomes will be on our bodies doing it this way.
In the long term, huh? What's a key message that you want to tell your filmmaking students when you're teaching?
Well, I think it's very important to have a clear vision of whatever it is, whatever genre, whatever medium you're using, to really crystallize that image in your own mind and then do your best to put that image out there, because there's always a gap between what you imagine and what you make, and that's part of what makes you do the next thing. But I think knowing what it is you want to say is the most important thing. Then how it looks, how it's going to resonate and draw in the audience, resonate with and draw in the audience to the whole story, you know, and no matter if it's news or documentary or comedy, it's still a story. We're storytelling creatures. So how do you know what your story is? Tell it in a way that will make other people want to listen to it and be moved by it or learn from it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you get students who want to create some big blockbuster, or are they really interested in subject and communication via the documentary?
They're interested in subject and communication. We limit them to shorter pieces because, if the longer piece is going to fall apart, you better do a small gem of a piece than something that's, you know, this long piece that doesn't work. But some schools are more blockbuster mentality. I think we're more, what's the story you're telling?
With a message.
Mm-hmm.
You're working on a film called Visions of the Ancestors. Are you finished with that, or are you still working on it?
I'm still working on it. That's about the Huichol tribe in Mexico. They're one of the original tribes there. And I've been going to Mexico for a long time just because it's warm there in the winter, and I speak Spanish, and I love the food and the colors. But through going there, I began seeing the Huichol art, which is done with yarn and beads, very colorful.
It's beautiful.
And it tells their stories, their mythology. And I befriended a woman who's been buying and selling their art for 25 years. And through her, I've begun, because I always have my camera and I'm always working on something, I've begun interviewing the shaman. And I did interview them on forgiveness. I have a section on that. I interviewed them about growing older. And now it's just about their culture, and I want to help people understand more about it because it's imperiled, like all old cultures are. But it's one of the few intact older cultures, and I just feel so privileged to be able to go to their mountain villages and the ceremonies and learn from them.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about what their art is. They have all kinds of animals in it still, and symbols. And
yeah, they have a pantheon of gods, and it's a very rich set of deities. So there's a fire and the earth and the corn and the water and the deer. And the deer is actually the main god, the blue deer. And they worship them, and there are a lot of stories about them, and there's a lot of very complex rituals done making offerings to these deities, thanking them for things, requesting things, but in a very complex steps along the way. Mm-hmm. So I didn't answer the question about what they look like. So they're beautiful blue deer. There are all
kinds messengers
of animals
to the gods, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that what they consider them?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite things is that the animals will have little squiggly lines coming out of their mouths that look like they're smoking cigarettes or something, but it actually represents them speaking and communicating and being those mediums between the worlds, between the worlds of the deities and our worlds of human beings.
Uh-huh. And was it hard for you to ingrain yourself into some of these cultural, I would think some of them are secrets. Were people open about wanting to talk about their culture? And
they don't tell me the secrets. I'm an outsider.
these sacred paintings?
They're very proud of their culture, and they're very happy to tell us about it. At this point, they're very dependent on the tourists and the travelers for buying their work because it's one of their main sources of income. They live a very frugal existence. The women often have to go long distances hauling water. But my favorite line that when I was interviewing them about getting older and facing death, I asked one of the women, and this is in a very small, very austere mountain village, if her people were afraid of dying. And she said, no, we're not alone and we have enough to eat, so we're not afraid of death. And then she asked me, well, are your people afraid of dying? And I said, yes, we are. And she said, why? You have those things. And all I could think was, good question. And to me, that's the core question. That's what makes me interested in learning from people who we think of as being behind us.
But yeah, or primitive. And so when this film is finished, what are you hoping to convey with it? Just telling people about the culture or teaching them something about death and aging that we are afraid to even confront?
Yeah, I'm going to do a few versions. One will be a short version that they can sell to tourists when they buy their art so they can understand something about the symbols of the art, the way it's made, the culture. It's made, they put beeswax and pitch and they press this yarn or these little beads into it. Another version would be more political because there are a lot of issues about schools coming into the Huicho villages, which is wonderful. The Mexican government has put schools in the villages, but they are in Spanish, and so the children are starting to lose their language. The children can't go do the ceremonies at the same time with the families, and so it's a great thing that they're learning, but it's whenever a culture loses its language, it loses a great deal of its culture too, so those political parts of it. And I want to do a third version that's a video art piece about why I, this middle-class woman from New York, is drawn to these old cultures, because I'm very consistently drawn to them. Bali, Haiti, Mexico.
Do you have any way of conveying to us why you're so interested in all these cultures at this moment?
I think they have a wisdom that we've lost, and I think that their belief in the invisible is something that I share, the power of the invisible.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think you'll ever want to make commercial films? Or will you continue just making documentaries?
No, even when the most commercial things I did was when I worked in New York as a writer, producer, director. I did a lot of corporate things. But even then I was writing screenplays and having some success with them. But they were never, one was about living in a cave on Crete, which I did for several months with a view of the Mediterranean Sea out in front of me. So I'm kind of non-commercial person.
Well, what other subjects are you thinking about doing? We only have about 2 minutes left.
I want to finish work on the Huicho piece, and I haven't looked further down than that because I have 30 hours of footage, and I'm going back in late May and early June probably for another ceremony, so I'm focusing on that for now.
Uh-huh. And are there documentary filmmakers that you admire?
Oh, well, I think more of video artists, which would be Bill Viola, because that's more my background. I come to the documentary from that, who does very meditative, poetic pieces. Maya Deren, who is a filmmaker in the 40s and 50s, who also does poetic visions. I think it's the poetry of spirit that captivates me, and so those are the ones I look to.
Well, Mara, we have run out of time. I really look forward to some of these future works, and I recommend highly, if anybody can get a hold of it, watch the film Forgiveness. It's absolutely powerful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.